From Ground Zero Radio, this is Democracy Now!
In these times of war and uncertainty, we need more peace, not less, more freedoms, not less freedoms, and more creativity, not the closing down of our minds and spirits.
Hearts and Hands, Creating Community in Violent Times. As Wall Street Journal correspondent Daniel Pearl remains missing in Pakistan, we'll hear a plea to Osama bin Laden from journalist Robert Fisk to release his friend. And new interim Pacifica director Dan Coughlin on the looting of Pacifica. The network is now almost $5 million in debt, almost half the budget of the foundation. All that and more coming up. Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. In an attempt to quell growing international outrage, President Bush announced yesterday that the Geneva Convention would be applied to Taliban captives being held in Cuba, but not to al-Qaeda detainees. The decision will not impact the day-to-day treatment of prisoners, in part because the president continues to deny them prisoner of war status. This despite calls from the United Nations, the International Committee of the Red Cross, and major human rights organizations. Legal experts say Bush's statements represent no change in the current U.S. policy of defying international law on treatment of prisoners. Enron's former CEO Jeffrey Skilling told a skeptical House subcommittee yesterday he was unaware of financial problems at the company when he left 4 months before it collapsed. His claims, however, were contradicted almost immediately by other senior executives who testified they repeatedly warned him about conflicts of interest and questionable company practices. Skilling's the most prominent former Enron executive thus far to answer questions from Congress, and he's one of the only ones who has not invoked his Fifth Amendment right against self-incrimination. But Skilling was anything but forthcoming. He repeatedly said he was in the dark about company improprieties and further rankled lawmakers by claiming he could not recall his specific role in the off-the-books partnerships at the heart of the Enron scandal. Democrats and Republicans alike said they found Skilling's testimony hard to believe, and they confronted him in one of the most pointed and memorable exchanges since eight top tobacco executives were questioned in April 1994. India and Russia are expected to sign a wide-ranging military protocol today, paving the way for several billions of dollars worth of defense deals that could alter the strategic balance in the region. The protocol is also likely to steer the longtime military allies away from simple supply towards the area of defense joint development and production. The Russian Deputy Prime Minister's four-day visit to India has involved intense negotiations for India to lease two Russian nuclear submarines and two long-range strategic bombers. India's neighbor and rival Pakistan has no such vessels, and China's nuclear submarines are extremely outdated. Today, the country's number one insurance company, MetLife, announced it's setting aside $250 million to settle a class action lawsuit that stems from charges it sold small life insurance policies to African Americans at higher prices than whites. MetLife's settlement will be the largest on record in a race-based pricing case. The practice of selling small-value life policies to black policyholders at higher prices than whites was widespread in the industry until the 1970s. In some areas of the United States, the practice survived into the late 1990s. Insurers rationalized that African Americans were more likely to die younger, therefore should pay higher premiums. More than 90 U.S. insurers, including Prudential, the number two U.S. life insurer, are under investigation for race-based pricing by state insurance regulators. Pakistani police said they formally arrested three men in the southern city of Karachi on Friday, accusing them of involvement in the kidnapping of U.S. reporter Daniel Pearl. The three who were detained earlier this week would be formally charged tomorrow when police ask a magistrate to remand them for further questioning. Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl disappeared in the volatile port city of Karachi on January 23rd as he tried to contact Islamic groups and trace links between Osama bin Laden's al-Qaeda network and alleged shoe bomber Richard Reid. Police said the three men were traced through two emails sent in the week after the kidnapping, threatening to kill Pearl if the United States did not release its prisoners from the Afghan war. The emails contained photographs of Pearl in captivity. We'll talk to Robert Fisk, journalist in Beirut, about his friend Daniel Pearl later in the program. Israel's Prime Minister Ariel Sharon began a three-day mission to Washington yesterday by urging President Bush to cut diplomatic contacts with Palestinian leader Yasser Arafat and to deal instead with his senior officials. The ex-general also expressed support for an American-led campaign against Iran and Iraq, two of Israel's chief enemies and two-thirds of Bush's, quote, axis of evil. Sharon's visit comes at a time when he has never been more popular in the White House. As he was paraded through Washington yesterday, he earned lavish praise for saying he expects to see a Palestinian state someday. But by far his main message to Bush was that the time had come to cultivate a new Palestinian leadership by dealing only with Arafat's more compliant officials. Washington so far has turned down this message. Meanwhile, Arafat's efforts to emphasize his commitment to the two-state solution by publishing an article in the New York Times have done little to improve his position. Inside the occupied territories, his authority is fraying further. This was evident in Jenin yesterday, where dozens of Palestinian gunmen stormed a police jail and freed six militants. A further 20 were said to have escaped in Nablus, apparently fearing they would be bombed in their cells. Ariel Sharon recently said he wished that Arafat had been killed 20 years ago in South Lebanon.
No vayas muy lejos. Mírate al espejo, porque cuando mires no te va a gustar. Tu cara es morena y quieres ser güera.
Y bien que te comes tu taco y memela. Y bien que te comes tu taco y memela.
Saleh Sobrando, Lila Downs, she dedicates her CD, Border, to the Mexican migrants, the spirits of those who have died crossing the line. You are listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio. I'm Amy Goodman, joined by my co-host, Juan Gonzalez. Welcome, Juan.
Good day to all of our listeners around the country on this bright, beautiful day in New York.
Well, Juan, there's an interesting front page piece in the New York Times today about the toxins at Ground Zero. You're the person who broke the story of how dangerous it was to be in that area months ago. The EPA came down very hard, as well as your own newspaper, on your reporting.
The New York Times has finally decided to address the problem, of course, but the piece is basically an apology. It doesn't at all begin. For the first time, recognize that the Federal Environmental Protection Agency and other health officials made a major blunder, as the Times calls it, by telling people that everything was safe when they really didn't know. But it doesn't begin. It still raises, basically says that science really can't tell us whether there's a problem or not, and people are justified for feeling uneasy about how the government has been reporting stuff, but doesn't really even begin to get to the level of contamination and the other environmental issues that are still there in Ground Zero and in the neighborhoods around it. So, but at least the Times has finally woken up to the fact that there is a problem right here in the city.
Meanwhile, the Olympics begin today in Salt Lake City. Again, last night, as we talked about on the program yesterday, the Reebok Human Rights Awards were given out in a ceremony in Salt Lake City. And one of the four recipients, under 30 human rights activists in the world, Dita Sari of Indonesia refused her $50,000 award, did not come from Indonesia, where she is a major labor organizer, served time in prison when she was 21 years old under the dictator Suharto. Speaking about sports, I don't know how many people watched the Super Bowl last Sunday. I can't claim that I did.
You're probably one of the few people in America who didn't, Amy.
But not only are full-page ads running in major U.S. newspapers bearing the message, drug money helps support terrorism, but these ads follow a series of TV commercials that aired during Sunday's Super Bowl, the biggest advertising day of the year. In the past, government anti-drug ads have focused largely on the impact of drugs on the people using them. However, tactics have changed since September 11th. In one of the newspaper ads, a young person says, "Last weekend I washed my car, hung out with a few friends, and helped murder a family in Colombia." The underlying message suggests buying drugs helps fund so-called terrorism. If the U.S. government is concerned about killing people in Colombia, maybe they should look at their own Plan Colombia that is sending more than $1 billion to Colombia and supporting a well-known human rights abusing military there.
And drug dealing military as well. But interestingly enough, this ad comes just as the Bush administration is attempting to change its policy in Colombia and begin to redirect more money toward direct aid of protecting the oil pipeline in northern Colombia against guerrillas. So the pretense of even fighting a drug war is being dropped now by the Bush administration, as they want to redirect a lot of that aid now into direct putting down of the guerrilla movement in Colombia.
Well, as the U.S. government uses the so-called war on terrorism to fund militaries around the world as an excuse to fund those militaries, we also have been looking here at home at what's going on in the United States, at the militarization of the police, at violence at home in various communities. And we're joined right now by Luis Rodriguez. He is author of Hearts and Hands, Creating Community in Violent Times. Luis Rodriguez joins us has joined us also in the past talking about issues of violence in America's young people, also specifically talking about gangs, something he's directly experienced in his growing up, and also with his son, who now is serving a life sentence in prison. Luis, welcome to Democracy
Well,
Now.
Thank you for having me here.
Violent times. Certainly, we're living in them. I think back to Columbine and the shootings at the high school there, and President Clinton saying to the country's parents, "You have to teach your children that they can solve issues nonviolently." And he said this against a backdrop of the U.S. dropping bombs on Yugoslavia
exactly.
at the time.
Right.
But kids learn from their elders. Yeah. You have a very different message.
Well, I think it's very important for us to. You can't just talk one thing and then do the other. And kids are very keen about hypocrisies. And sometimes they don't understand why things are going on and they take it very badly. They get depressed, suicidal. But I think it's important for us to say that if we're going to resolve things creatively, humanely, compassionately, that's the way we should do it. And especially if you're talking about leadership and countries, you're talking about a whole world, global network of people, how do you resolve these issues without having to resort to war, without having to resort to civil liberties being taken away? But young people are questioning, and I think we have to not just incorporate what their thinking is, but to learn to recreate community by looking at youth again differently, being able to see how youth bring in new ideas, new compassions, new capacities to be able to change the things that we need to change in this country.
Well, you know, in your book, you talk about many of the conversations you've had with young folks who have been in gangs at one point. At one point in the book, you talk about the desire for many of these young people to go out in a blaze of glory, yeah. that somehow this is the image that they feel, that this is the way they're going to have a final imprint of their lives on the world.
Yeah.
Can you talk a little bit about that and where that comes from and how that relates to the whole issue of violence?
Well, I think it's directed to this deep disaffection that young people have in this country. And it runs across all, middle-class kids have it as well as the poor kids, but where they feel that there's no meaning in this world. And where do they find it? If they're willing to die for a gang or for their girlfriend or boyfriend, for something that seems minor to the rest of us, is we haven't been able to create a world that's big enough and important enough for them to want to live and die for. We haven't given them something meaningful enough to say, you know what, I'm going to try to have a cause or something important to do in my life. Instead, they think this is it. This is the gang, my body, or whatever it might be. This is the most important thing I have going on.
And in terms of the, I know Los Angeles, where you're from and where you were raised, was basically held up as the worst example of gang violence about a decade ago, along with Phoenix and some of the other places. What's happened in Los Angeles and in the Southwest among the gangs in recent years, and has there been any kind of any motion forward in terms of how young people relate to gangs and violence out there?
Well, the violence went down briefly, and then it's gone up again. And it always happens because nobody's doing anything what I believe substantial enough. They did gang injunctions. They did 3 strikes and you're out in the state of California. They started trying young people as adults. They thought this was going to put a cap to the violence in the streets, and the violence did go down, not necessarily because of those things, but it's going up again because obviously we're looking at deeper issues. What about the economic situation, the poverty rates? What about the barriers to college education, jobs that exist in those communities? To me, I keep thinking to say that the gangs are really symptomatic of something deeper. If you keep looking at the gangs and say they're the problem, you put so much money behind it, you're not looking at the front end of it. What is creating a gang situation, not just that the gangs are bad people and we need to do something about it?
You talk in your book about Columbine, about the shootings in Colorado, and the difference between how those who did that and went down in their so-called blaze of glory and the way young Latino kids or kids in gangs are portrayed when they engage in violence.
Yeah, I felt, and it's not that they did a lot for Columbine. I still felt those kids were not properly looked at, but they did bring in a lot of attention to their grief, to their sorrows, to their alienation, which is very similar to the grief and sorrow and alienation of kids in the inner city. But in the inner city, they don't do that. They don't come and try to explain away why things are happening. They just say these kids are rotten, they're no good, they need to be pushed away. So while these kids are being given a lot of grief counseling, therapy, and support, which I think is great, and they probably should need more of it, in the inner city where kids have lost a dozen people in a year's time, that's not the way people respond to them. And again, it's just more jails, more police, and more throwing them out of the schools and pushing them out into the world of the violence and crime. So I do think there's hypocrisy in how this is being dealt with. And again, not to put down that these kids in these middle-class communities don't need to be paid attention to. There's something deep going on with them and that we should pay attention. But I do feel that it's just, again, the same issue where you feel that they have several tiers in which they work at several levels in which they decide which policies are going to be the ones that are going to implement versus another group of people, such as kids in the urban core communities.
And in terms of how you can harness the enormous energy and creativity that young people have in a positive direction, what are some of the things that you've concluded are critical to do?
Well, one thing I did is I tried to make it happen. I tried to create institutions or organizations that could begin to harness that. For example, there's one group I mentioned a lot in the book, Youth Struggling for Survival in Chicago. That was really created not as a youth program, but as a way to rebuild those relationships. We had adults, families, and young people come together who didn't talk to each other, didn't know about each other, to kind of force each other, look at each other and say, what are we going to do as a community? How do we relate again? And no matter how hard it is, and no matter how bad some of these kids can be as far as some of the things that they do, that we would hang in with them. And it took a long time to develop that. But the end result of it is the young people, who some of them were violent, some of them were in prison, some of them are drugs. The majority of those kids became leaders of the community. They became active in the community. They let go of the drugs and the violence. Some of them are mentoring other youth because I think that they began to feel a connection that they didn't feel with community. Finally, they felt that this community, at least even in some temporary minor sense, was something that they could put some effort themselves to make better versus I don't care what happens and what happens to them or me.
Luis Rodriguez, in your book, you begin with a quote, when the culture fails to draw out the innate beauty of its children, it's deciding to turn that beauty to violence. Can you talk about your own life, how mm-hmm. you got into gangs, how you got out of them, mm-hmm. and then your son, who you write very movingly about in Hearts and Hands?
Well, I joined a gang, I think, for the same reason a lot of these kids did. I'm completely fractured communities. My own parents, who lovingly were great, but they were working too hard. They didn't have time for a kid like me. I joined a gang to belong, to be valued somewhere, to be embraced. And, of course, it does mean that sometimes you give up a lot of yourself for something that shouldn't happen, like some of the destructive things that we did. And I began to realize as I got a little older that I was very capable of hurting people, very capable of taking the drugs, and I really wanted to die. I saw it as a suicidal, homicidal thing. But what happened in my case is there was an intervention by other adults, leaders, for example, in the Chicano movement of 30 years ago. And that was important because they weren't just people trying to be a friend and help me out. They were people with a cause, as I say. And somehow I connected that cause in such a way where it became bigger than just the gang. And I began to see how the gang violence was hurting our communities, hurting me. Yeah, there was a time I was part of it. It made sense, but it stopped making sense for me. And it was the help of these kind of mentoring and teachers and educators that came into my life that I think was a key link, which is something I'm trying to replicate. Now, with my son, he joined a gang, you know, many years later when he was 15 years old. And I tried to see if I could help him develop another sense of his importance, of his value. And I created this youth group partly to help him, to have other adults and young people help in the process, because it's hard for a father really to do it, even though fathers should be good fathers. They need help from outside of their family too. But my son, unfortunately, I don't think he had the connections that I had or even some of his friends got. Some of his friends I helped mentor. Some of them I helped get through the jails and drugs and stuff like that. But he didn't quite make it. And when 21 years old, he was arrested for 3 counts of attempted murder and was facing 40 years to life. Now, he didn't actually get the life sentence, by the way. We fought for 2.5 years so he would get 28 years. But you can imagine, as a family, that's a victory in these days where you're sitting there and you're thankful for 28 years for your son. It shows how bad the situation is.
Well, I think what you raise here is critically important. You talk about the outside intervention that occurred in your life, but that sometimes it's not enough for the mother or the father to try to get the child heading in the right direction, because there are too many other emotional barriers there that you actually do need an outside intervention, and also a sense for young people that it's not their problem, but that there are societal factors, forces that are at work. And once they understand that, it's almost as if you begin to grasp control of your own destiny. And
I agree with that,
I think what you're talking about in terms of the intervention, the same thing happened in New York and Chicago and other places with the political movement of the 60s. And many folks, the Young Lords as a gang, for instance, in Chicago tried to turn completely around into a political organization. The Latin Kings tried for a while, but they had problems. And so that really what happens is, once you begin to get an understanding of the societal factors that have led to your particular situation, you have more control over, as you say in the book, the need for practice and changing oneself and changing one's environment.
I think that's a very important point, because it isn't so much that you're going to just, quote, save a kid, or you're going to just change them and make them good citizens. Is you have to make them active participants in whatever needs to happen in their community. You have to give them enough skills and knowledge and a sense of confidence that they in fact can do it. And then you have to know that there's a community that's going to benefit. Not only that, acknowledge that you're doing it. Without these things, kids get lost. And even kids that do good things, if they don't get that proper acknowledgement, that resources, that assistance, some of them will back off, because they need to know that what they're doing is actually impactful for the whole community. So I agree. And in the 60s, there was a lot of that. We had gangbangers become active community leaders. And then we also saw how the government played a role in undermining that, because with the Young Lords, they went after them. As soon as it became political, quote, they went after them. The story with the Latin Kings was basically they were as political as the Young Lords, but they stopped. They made a decision. We're not going to go this way. And the Latin Kings is now one of the biggest street organizations in the country. You know what I'm saying? Mm-hmm. So what happened? The Latin Kings survived because they decided not to be political versus of course, that changed in New York City recently, but, you know, especially in Chicago, versus the Young Lords that went all out for the community, and they were smashed as best they could by the government.
Well, I want to thank you very much for being with us.
My
Luis
pleasure.
Rodriguez, his new book is called Hearts and Hands, Creating Community in Violent Times. Thanks for stopping by. I know you're heading now to Washington, D.C.
Yeah, anytime. Thank you.
Thank you. You are listening to Democracy Now! When we come back, we go to Lebanon to journalist Robert Fisk, who has an appeal for the release of Wall Street Journal reporter Daniel Pearl. Stay with us.
As we go marching, marching, we battle to for men, for they are women's children. from birth until life closes. Hearts starve as well as bodies. Give us bread, but give us roses. As we go marching, marching, unnumbered women dead go crying through our singing their ancient call for bread. Small art and love and beauty, their drudging spirits new. Yes, it is bread we fight for, but we fight for roses too.
Bread and Roses here on Democracy Now!, breaking the sound barrier. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez. CBS News is reporting the first attempt to rescue journalist Daniel Pearl from his captors in Pakistan has ended in disappointment. After zeroing in on prime kidnapping suspect Sheikh Omar Saeed, Pakistani police reportedly called him on Wednesday and attempted to negotiate. They told Saeed they had arrested members of his family and that they would release them only if he would give up Pearl. Well, Saeed appeared to agree to these conditions, promising to release his journalist captive within hours. But when the appointed hour arrived, Pearl was not freed. Saeed was nowhere in sight. Now police are admitting their investigation has faltered and the trail has gone cold. Meanwhile, just days before this botched attempt at bargain chip diplomacy, London Independent correspondent Robert Fisk made a different kind of contribution to the rescue effort. In an article that doubled as an open letter to Osama bin Laden, he asked the influential leader to help secure his reporter friend's release. The letter reads like this: Daniel Pearl should not be a hostage. The photograph released by his kidnappers, manacled and awaiting execution, was profoundly shocking for me because he and his young French wife were the last Westerners I saw in Islamabad before I returned to Beirut last December. I had just been beaten by an Afghan crowd and arrived, still bruised and very bloody, at the guest house on China Road, which has been home to many journalists over the past months. Well, Democracy Now! Spoke with Robert Fisk in Pakistan just days after his beating. We go to him again today, this time at his home in Lebanon, to talk about his friend Daniel Pearl and this unusual plea to Osama bin Laden. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Robert.
Hi, how are you?
It's very good to have you with us. Can you talk more about who Daniel Pearl is?
Well, first of all, it's not China Road, it's Chinar Road. I just do that for a tiny geographical location. Secondly, I think if you describe him as my friend, I think we're pushing the envelope a little bit far. I got back from the border where I had been badly beaten to Islamabad, the capital of Pakistan, and I went back to the guest house in Chinar Road where many journalists have stayed. And I hadn't met Daniel Pearl before, nor his young wife, Marianne. The moment I entered, they said, "Are you Robert Fisk?" I mean, I was covered in bandages and a lot of bloody wounds on me. And they were very kind to me. They took me to their room. They let me make phone calls to find out numbers I'd lost. My contacts book was stolen during the beating I sustained on the border. They were a couple who were evidently very much in love. I mean, they were very young. You can kind of tell in a room where it's very sort of snug and cozy, and coffee's on hand, and they you know, it was very moving to find two people in love who were journalists. And I took Daniel's card. He wasn't a long acquaintance, an old friend or anything. But anyway, I returned to Lebanon that night, and then went off on holiday to Ireland. And the next thing I saw of Daniel was this grotesque photograph of him with a pistol to his head. And then the photograph of his young wife, Marianne, French wife, speaking up for him, as she said, with an open heart. And my feeling was that, I thought two things. First of all, and I have to tell you, my telephone is playing up in an extraordinary way at the moment, as it always does when I talk about such matters. Miraculously, I'm sure it's the Bangladesh intelligence service. remarkably, what happened is that, number one, I saw his picture, and I remembered what happened in Lebanon when journalists were taken hostage. The first thing that happened was the journalists were kept for months and then years. Terry Anderson of the Associated Press for almost 7 years, a very close friend of mine. And that while this happened, the reporters left Beirut, and with the exception of three of us, including myself and the Independent, and the great tragic events of Lebanon, the great battle between the Hezbollah and the Lebanese army, the Israeli army in southern Lebanon, the attacks and suffering of Palestinian civilians in the camps under Lebanese militia attack, were not reported. And then none of the reporters actually came back. So what happened was that the system of kidnapping journalists effectively chopped off the legs of those who wanted the truth, or at least their version of the truth, to come out. And as a result of that, one naturally felt immediately in terms of Daniel Pearl. Well, look, here we are. We have tens of thousands of Pakistanis living under the poverty line. We have tens of thousands of Afghan refugees living in Pakistan. We have the whole Afghan water report, which includes more than 3,000 civilians killed by U.S. bombs, perhaps more, I'm sure more, than killed in the crimes against humanity in New York and Washington on September 11th last year. And here are these people, again, telling journalists to leave the country within 3 days, as they did last week. What is the possible benefit of this when they must know, and they're educated people surely, that the Americans will not give up their prisoners from Guantanamo Bay, which is what they're asking?
But Robert Fisk, this is Juan Gonzalez. I'd like to ask you, this report that the Pakistani government seized the family members of Omar Saeed Sheikh, Saeed Sheikh. I understand the need to be able to get Mr. Pearl freed, but the idea that a government kidnaps family members of a suspected terrorist.
I was very surprised at this, quite astonished. But I have to tell you, I'm about 2,300 kilometers from Pakistan. I'm in Beirut at the moment, and I have not spoken yet to contacts of mine in the country. I don't know how true this is, and I wouldn't want to make a comment which might prove to be preposterous or stupid at the end.
What about these accusations that have swirled around that Daniel Pearl works for the Mossad, that he works for the Central Intelligence Agency? What about journalists like you who travels around the world dealing with these accusations?
Well, that's a very good point. You know, I don't talk to any Western embassy officials because I don't want these accusations ever to be made against me. But I think that to suggest that every other journalist who doesn't do that is therefore some kind of agent is preposterous, it's ridiculous, it's stupid.
Wait, just one second. When you say that, you do interview people. So what do you mean when you say you don't talk to?
I do not have any contact with any Western NATO embassies in the Middle East or anywhere else. I don't speak to them. Full stop. That's what I mean.
And you do that why?
Well, I'll be very frank with you. Way back in the 80s when the hostages were being taken, I was telephoned by a member of a Western NATO embassy and told that this person wanted to speak to me urgently in a restaurant about a matter of humanitarian affairs. I went to the restaurant after originally saying, look, you know, you do have a reputation of being a spook. That person said, no, totally untrue. I was here in Beirut. This was a very dangerous place. The person turned up for the meal with four armed bodyguards and immediately started asking about an armed militia in Lebanon. These were not questions from someone who was interested in humanitarian affairs. this was someone who was interested in military affairs. And I immediately finished the lunch, walked out, left. The next morning, I received a visit from a very bearded Shiite Muslim man here in Beirut who said, "Mr. Robert, you have been talking to a spy yesterday. We know this person." The heat was very strong, as they say, so I decided I would go and spend a couple of weeks in southern Lebanon. So, in fact, I spent 2 weeks with the Irish battalion of the United Nations peacekeeping force in southern Lebanon. I didn't leave the country. I just got out of Beirut for a couple of weeks. Now, I was very disturbed by this. Here was someone from a Western embassy who was prepared, if it's true, that they were a spy. I use the word in quotation marks, the intelligence agent, whatever. Was prepared to compromise my safety for their information. And some 3 years later, I was at a conference in England, at Ditchley, in Oxfordshire, where the sister of this person came up to me and said, "I'm very worried. I think that X," her sister, it's a woman I'm talking about, "is an intelligence agent. She said she was an intelligence agent. And I suddenly thought, how dare this person allow me to become a target or to be set up because she wanted information, having told me it was a humanitarian question. So the answer to your question is, having had a Western embassy, and I'll speak frankly, my own British embassy, have a diplomat prepared to ask me questions on humanitarian affairs, which were not actually humanitarian, and which placed me in great jeopardy, I decided on that date I would never speak to a Western NATO diplomat again, and I never, ever have."
Well, Robert Fisk, on that note, I want to thank you very much for being with us. A great journalist from The Independent in Britain recently came back from Afghanistan and has issued this appeal for the release of Daniel Pearl, the Wall Street Journal reporter in Pakistan. You are listening to Democracy Now! And before we end this segment, as we talk about foreign correspondence, we're joined right now by John Alpert, who is the head of Downtown Community Television, where we're based, in a firehouse in Chinatown, New York. John Alpert, you may remember over the last few weeks, we got in touch with as he was traveling through Afghanistan. We may have been banned from the airways of Pacifica at that time. I don't know about all the Pacifica stations hearing us, but certainly community radio stations and on public access stations. And these were incredible firsthand reports as he traveled with his daughter Tammy and Masuda Sultan, who is an Afghan New Yorker who went back to Afghanistan to visit her family. Over the dusty roads of Afghanistan, Masuda with the satellite phone in her hand, describing how just hours before she had met with members of her family who are now refugees in Pakistan, describing how 19 members of Masuda's family had died as a result of the U.S. bombing. John, you came back and we checked in with you as you were then trying to sell your footage, give your footage to various networks in this country. It wasn't that easy.
No, it wasn't that easy, and I thought it was deja vu because, as you remember, when we came back from Iraq during the Gulf War, we had the first footage that proved the smart bombs weren't smart, and we were killing a lot of people. And I could not get that on the air. And here we were again with the story of what happened to Masuda's family in this little village. We couldn't get it on the air. It was really frustrating. But we were persistent. CBS, the early show, has been...
What did some of the executives tell you that you showed the footage to?
Oh, there was a guy from Fox who was here who said, "This is never getting on the air. We can't show this." I mean, it was spitting into the political wind, and they weren't going to show this. We were going to show a lot of footage on the CBS early show, but they were also reluctant to show this. But ultimately, and in fact this morning, we broadcast a short portion. But I was really wondering what the new Bill Moyers show was going to do. This is a program that carries a lot of respect because of Bill Moyers' reputation. And I was hoping that we could get it broadcast there. And they saw the footage, and they said they would broadcast, and it's going to be on tonight.
Now,
on Bill Moyer's new show Now?
Yeah. And I was watching some of the other segments, too.
So it's going to be on at what time?
Here in New York, it's at 9 o'clock, but PBS is a little bit anarchistic.
It depends on the,
right,
the city.
So but it's going to be on tonight. And they have a lot of they examine the moral responsibility of the United States in waging a war like this. They have satellite reports from Kandahar talking about other examples of people who were killed in American bombing. They're really doing a quite thorough examination of it. I'm happy to be part of it.
Well, Bill Moyers, of course, is one of the few people still in corporate media on a regular basis that has maintained some kind of a semblance of commitment to bringing out news and information. I actually caught that show last week for the first time. I was pleasantly surprised by some of the material he had on there.
Right. Yeah.
At the same time, today in New York, Global Exchange is holding a news conference with Masouda Soltan, highlighting the recent revelations in the press that the U.S. military acknowledged the killing of so-called friendly forces in the village of Hazar Kadam in southern Afghanistan and compensated the grieving families of the fallen by distributing fistfuls of $100 bills. U.S. War Secretary Donald Rumsfeld, while denying knowledge of the payments, agreed he would expect U.S. forces to offer apologies if investigations reveal the wrong people were killed. What was it like to be with Masouda in the footage that you're going to be airing tonight as she learned about what happened to her family?
Well, initially she was overcome with grief. She heard about it in Pakistan first from her relatives, and they began listing, and it takes a long time to list all the people that were killed, and she just sat there as her cousins, her uncles, all these people were listed. She couldn't stop crying. When she got to the village, I think she was more shocked than anything because there wasn't anything that was left there. It was just a pile of mud, and she had never been there before, and there wasn't anything left. There were big craters. There were little souvenirs. There was a handkerchief that belonged to one of her dead nieces. There were some school books. There was a baby bottle. And as she walked through this, it took us about 2 or 3 hours to film, and then she said, "John, I just can't do this anymore. I just can't. I know it's important for people to see this, but I can't take anymore."
She described how her family that had been in Kandahar left, went 50 miles out of the city to a farmhouse because they were afraid of being bombed in Kandahar.
Right.
And it was at this isolated farmhouse that the U.S. started dropping the bombs as the women and children were running outside to try to escape.
Right. In Kandahar, her family lived in a neighborhood where Taliban members had houses. And they said, "Geez, we got to get out of here. I mean, we're going to get creamed." And so they went, I think her cousin's husband had land in this isolated village. I mean, I can't begin to describe how small it is. The whole village basically is the size of a city block here. There were only 30 permanent residents. But 40 members of Masouda's family figured nobody's going to hit us here. I mean, it's absolutely in the middle of nowhere. It's just desert and camels all around. And they were safe for the first 2 weeks. They did bring tents with them, and they had a generator. So if the spy, whatever we have up there, is looking down there, there was some new activity there. You could think that maybe they thought, well, this is unusual, we better investigate it. What Masouda's family thinks is that Afghans were being paid a bounty to supply targeting information, and they had financial incentives to give targets because they weren't paid for wrong information. They weren't paid for things that weren't bombed. They were paid for targets that were hit.
It's very much like police departments use undercover informants to tell them where the drugs are being sold. And so many informants, because they're getting money, will say, "Hey, sure, this drug's being sold here," and go, and then they bust down the door and find there are no drugs.
Right.
You know, except here, they're not even busting down doors. They're just dropping the bombs in the sky.
And this attack occurred in the middle of the night. The thing that really needs to be investigated, and I think where the moral line is very sharply drawn, is that we have very good night vision equipment in our helicopters. And if...
They may be your helicopters.
Well, I paid for them. You paid for them. I mean, you know, there's the technology is available to differentiate women and children, even in the nighttime. And all the people that we spoke to talked about the helicopters lingering at the village and pouring machine gun fire down and killing women and children.
And then Masuda came back to Kandahar and went to the U.S. Marine base there, or the military base at the airport, and asked them why. Because she said what she promised her family members, she'd try to find out why her family in particular was the target.
Right. She didn't get much information, and it's quite possible that these guys did not know. It appears that an attack like this would be done by the special forces and not the Marines. And she's still trying to find out what happened to her family.
Well, John Alpert, thanks for being with us. Congratulations on being able finally to get your footage out. It's going to appear on Bill Moyer's PBS program tonight, Friday night. The new program is called Now.
Right. Don't watch the Olympics tonight. Watch this.
You are listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute to look at the state of a plundered network. Yep, it's our network, folks. It's Pacifica. Stay with us.
When the people leave, the leaders they will have to follow. And all their lies and their alibis they will have to swallow. And it's you that has the authority. For the one who is right is the majority. When the people lead, people take the lead. Children, you got to take your lead, or you shall be led astray. So as long as someone else controls your history, the truth remain just a mystery.
People lead. Ben Harper here on Democracy Now! Resistance Radio. I'm Amy Goodman with Juan Gonzalez as we move into our last segment. Juan?
Well, Amy, what we're going to do in this segment is look at the situation with our own network, the Pacifica Network, and we have with us Dan Coughlin, the interim executive director, who is joining us from Washington, D.C., where he's at the Pacifica headquarters. And we're going to try to look at the report that was just issued yesterday by an accounting firm, an independent accounting firm that was asked to come in and look at the Pacifica books by the new interim board of Pacifica. So I want to welcome Dan to Democracy Now!
Thanks, Juan. It's great to be with you and Amy.
Dan, could you tell us a little bit about the report that's just been issued and what the state of the network is in terms of its financial situation?
Yeah, Juan, the Pacifica board a few weeks ago appointed a accounting firm to come into Pacifica and do an audit. Audit might be too strong a word, but an independent review of Pacifica's books. And this is part of a new period of openness and transparency at the network, and the firm just finished its report, which we are busily distributing all across the system, the Pacifica system, to the Pacifica affiliates as well, and we'll be putting it up on the website of Pacifica.org so that everybody can see the state of the finances of Pacifica. Essentially, Juan, it describes a financial morass that many of us had not quite expected to be that bad. Basically, Pacifica faces a deficit of $4.8 million. That's what we owe right now, $4.8 million. And just to put that into context, this is an organization that has an annual budget of about $10.5 million. So we're talking about close to $5 million as of December 31st, this is, that the network is in the hole. And just to break that down for you, that can be broken down into three parts. One is about $2.5 million or so that is owed to large creditors, big law firms, primarily in Washington, D.C., big law firms, PR firms, security companies, ranging from well-known firms such as Williams & Connolly, law firm Fulbright and Jaworski, PR firms like West Hill Partners, another firm by the name of Strategic Decisions, a firm by the name of a law firm by the name of Epstein, Becker, and Green. And these compose, these are elite firms that, that charge Pacifica, you know, $400 an hour, $475 an hour for their services to this a small nonprofit. And now we owe them about $2.5 million. That's one part of the debt. The other part of the debt is really just operating expenses like telephone bills, utilities, transmitter costs, and that's about $2 million. And then there's another part of the debt, which is really this a rash of golden parachute severance packages that went out to former senior executives who left the network over the late last year, and they were paid out handsome severance packages, which we're working to renegotiate and reduce. So that is essentially a brief snapshot of the crisis that we face. But again, I want to let people know, you know, we're laying this out on the table. We're talking to the staffs, to unions around the network, to let everybody know what the situation is. And we are going to be making some moves real soon. And obviously those moves are going to be, one, on the one hand, rallying around to raise revenue for this national treasure, the Pacifica Radio Network, on the one hand. And on the other hand, we're going to have to cut costs. And that's going to be some hard decisions that everybody, all of us are going to have to make. But we're going to have to do them to save the network.
Now, in looking over the 20-page report last night, a few things stuck out as I read it. First of all, that apparently as of October of 2000, Pacifica had a surplus of $700,000, and it has now become a deficit of $4.7 million. So you're talking somewhere in the range of $5.5 to $6 million above and beyond its normal operating expenditures was spent by this former board in just basically a period of about 15 months. It's an incredible amount of money that just went through that was expended by these folks, or at least liabilities incurred, because obviously a good portion of this has not been paid yet. Could you, in terms of some of the expenditures that the accountants singled out that were especially glaring to you, aside from the legal expenses, which are astounding, I notice here that they did a breakdown of the payments to law firms. And on December 26th of 2000, which as far as I know is about 2 days after the Christmas coup, at WBAI, there were two payments made to the law firm of Epstein, Becker, and Green, for one for $147,000 and another one for $64,000.
Now, this is the law firm that a member of the board was on, and a lot of people charge conflict of interest that one of the members of the board of directors of Pacifica had the law firm representing Pacifica.
So that means, Dan, that 2 days after the Christmas coup, Epstein, Becker, and Green got $200,000 in legal in payments. These are legal payments. This is not what is actually still owed to them. Is that true?
That appears to be the case. That's what's in the report, and I think that's absolutely accurate. Juan, you've just highlighted one of a number of really staggering expenses that the previous administration has incurred, which we're still finding out about. At all levels of the budget, there was huge travel expenses, salary increases, folks. There was a complete disproportionate reality happening. One, a nonprofit, a five-station radio network, listener-supported, that relies upon unpaid workers and paid workers who work very hard to sustain this network on the one hand, and on the other hand, a small coterie of people recklessly spending listener money.
You've got figures, just two of the top people in the network, the national program director and the executive director, in 1 year in travel expenses alone, just last year, more than $250,000. Two people.
Well, that's what it appears to be. But let me say this. We understand these fees and these expenses are completely outrageous. But the fact of the matter is we need to work them out. We need to meet our obligations where we believe those obligations are justified and correct and proper, which we will do on the one hand. And on the other hand, we do have to, I think, move forward to the future, which is an exciting future, which is an essential part of what we're doing at Pacifica, especially in the times that we live in with the war in Afghanistan after 9/11. And we want to build the network back to where it has historically been, and that is at the tip of the arrow of time. And I think that is our challenge right now as we move forward, on the one hand, to return to what we do best on programming, and on the other hand, to meet our obligations as best we can and to stabilize the network fiscally so that we can do what we've been doing for 52 years.
Well, Dan, you know, there are those people who will say that this financial bloodletting is a result of an internal battle between two factions here at Pacifica, and that both sides are to blame for this erosion of the financial situation. I've heard that expressed by some people who are critical of both sides. What's your response to that?
Well, the response is in the auditing report. The auditors themselves, independent auditors, talk about gross negligence, talk about self-dealing, talk about conflicts of interest, talk about whether these accounts were pre-approved or not, talk about detailed time and billing records. The list is very detailed that, in fact, what happened over the last year and a half was nothing less than the reckless squandering, if not gross negligence, of listener resources on high-priced law firms, PR firms, travel expenses, and a range of unjustified expenses. It's not rocket science, Juan. We try to balance our household budgets. You know, you can't go on holiday flying first class to Paris, France, if you don't have the money. But that's what, in fact, was happening here at Pacifica over the last 15 months, as the auditor's report shows, a staggering decrease in operating capital, as they put it, of $6 million in 15 months. It's not sustainable to hire a law firm at $475 an hour for 15 months. It's just not going to work. And at the time, people understood that, raised that issue.
But Pacifica, Dan, according to this report, had 9 law firms. Was employing 9 different law firms.
Yeah, I lost count exactly. It looks that 9 may be the correct number. That's right.
What lessons do nonprofits have to learn from what happened at Pacifica? Again, about a $11 million budget foundation, $5 million in debt as a result of just 1 year, as dissidents, as listeners around the country, thousands of them, were demanding, taking to the streets, transparency in Pacifica.
Amy, this is, I think, the most exciting development here, because what has happened is that listeners around the country have said, enough of this nonsense. We demand some accountability about what is happening. And now, for the first time in U.S. media history, a national media network will be democratized, and thousands and tens of thousands of listeners around the country in the next year are going to be voting for the Pacifica leadership. And this is an extraordinary development in the history of the United States, and indeed in the history of the whole media and democracy movement. And that's why it's important that listeners around the country, especially in the 5 signal areas of Pacifica, join your local station, become a member, because that's going to give you voting rights to shape this network for the future. And this is the lesson that we've learned. We need accountability, we need transparency, we need democracy, and this publication of this report is the first step down that path.
And Dan, you're going to be posting this entire report on the Pacifica webpage so that people can see exactly how much money was spent for each of their stations as well as for the national office?
Yes, it should be up today, and that website is www.pacifica.org, and we'll put it up high on the website so folks can see it.
Dan Coughlin, thanks for joining us, Interim Executive Director of Pacifica Radio. That does it for the show. Our website is democracynow.org. Juan, as a head of the Pacifica campaign, you've called off the boycott of the network?
Yes, the boycott was called off actually 2 weeks ago, and I resigned as the chair of the campaign.
Well, it is great to have you back. Democracy Now! Produced by Miranda Kennedy with help from Lizzie Ratner and Jeremy Scahill, Anthony Sloan, our engineer. I'm Amy Goodman, and with Juan Gonzalez. Thanks for listening.
Thank you.